Hello and welcome to this week's Radio Dialect. Good afternoon and welcome to Dialect Radio. Hello to everyone in Bristol and listeners on Preston FM, that's 103.2 FM up there in Preston, and Unity FM on 93.5 FM in the Midlands.
Our guest this week is Sally Ray, who is the project manager of the Bristol Creatives Group. This will be of great interest to anyone in Bristol who loves the arts or is thinking of exploring a hidden artistic streak. Features this week are by Anthea Page, Tony Gosling, Michaela Dennis and Adio Leighton. Also to look forward to, we have Jeff Sparks in the studio giving us his What's On guide and, of course, the Song of the Week. I'm John Peters Coleman.
And I'm Michaela Dennis. Our first guest this week is Sally Ray, and she's here to give us an insightful overview of the Bristol Creative Group. Hi, Sally.
Hi there, Anne. How are you doing?
I'm very well, thank you. How are you?
Yeah, very well.
So tell me about the Bristol Creative Group.
Yeah, well, we're a network of visual and applied artists based in Bristol. Our members tend to be jewellery designer makers, ceramicists. So we mainly provide support via a website, www.bristolcreatives.co.uk, and through monthly networking events which happen on the last Thursday of each month called Creative Thursdays. We also send out a monthly e-bulletin that goes out the first week of every month, and currently that's going out to over 1,800 subscribers. The bulletin's free, comes into your inbox and is full of what's going on in Bristol with regards to open studios, arts trails, workshops. So if you fancy doing a ceramics evening class or you want to learn to life draw, sign up for one of our e-bulletins and you'll be able to find out what's going on.
That's really interesting. How long have you guys been going?
We've been going since 2006. We originally got a grant from the Arts Council and a little bit of money from Bristol City Council to set up a pilot scheme, which we did for 2 years. By the end of 2 years, we had over 1,000 people subscribed to our e-bulletins. And our money ran out in 2008, and we've been running sort of voluntarily, and also we're trying to launch a gold membership scheme at the moment to try and get people to pay an annual fee to be a member.
Myself.
And what they get for that is unlimited access on the website to post their own news events and also to be listed in our creative directory as well.
So it sounds like you've been pretty successful then after your kind of startup funding.
Absolutely. I mean, in Bristol, we've got several networking groups. There's Bristol Media, which is for screen-based animators, digital work, really, e-commerce, that kind of thing. And then there's also Theatre Bristol, which covers the theatrical side of things. So there was always a bit of a gap for the Visual and Applied Arts Network. I came to Bristol from South London via Totnes in Devon about 7 or 8 years ago. And it was really difficult to get a hook on what was going on in Bristol. Bristol's an incredibly creative city. There's loads of stuff going on. The last one, we had a couple that had just moved here from California, a young guy who'd just moved here from Cuba. I spoke to the Cuban guy and the American couple and said, well, you know, why did you come to Bristol? And they said they went online and searched for cities in the UK that would be a good place to come as artists. And Bristol was the winner by far. It's fantastic. What a great place to live.
So, I mean, that's why it's really important to have a group like yours, so people like that can find out other people in the area.
Yeah, absolutely. So you can just tap into what's going on. I mean, for example, I'm involved with a community arts project called Phoenix 52 based over in Barton Hill and Easton. And we're putting together an event on the 30th of October in St George's Park called Illuminate, which is a cross between Halloween, Mexican Day of the Dead and Diwali, the Hindu Festival of Light. And we're working with 11 or 12 artists and performers who we recruited through the Bristol Creatives Network. We put a message up on the notice board and in the e-bulletin, and people submitted proposals to do installations and interventions. And then we're going to promote the whole event through the Bristol Creatives Network as well. So that's free. So if you're around on Halloween night, on the Halloween weekend, and you want somewhere to bring the kids, we're asking everyone to dress up in fancy dress outfits and come along with their lanterns. We'll be running lantern making workshops, altar and mask making workshops during the day, and then in the evening we'll have a mariachi band and lots of strange and wonderful installations and interpretations of the Day of the Dead, Halloween and Diwali.
So you mentioned installations there. I mean, so what exactly would the art will be at this event?
Well, we've given people the theme, the very loose theme. So we've got giant puppets that will be doing walkabouts. We've got a couple of people are making altars and shrines. As I say, there'll be a little Mexican tienda selling pumpkin soup and cider, and we'll be having a lantern parade. So children and adults, I have to say, will be making lanterns during the daytime, and then we'll be part of the parade in the evening. The event starts at 5:30 on Saturday, the 30th of October, and runs until about 9 o'clock. Very family friendly, and it's all free.
Well, that's a good enough reason to go, if anything else.
Absolutely.
Do you find with your group that you have to collaborate with lots of other artists and groups within Bristol?
Yeah, I mean, that was one of the reasons that we set Bristol Creators up in the first place, is that artists very often want to collaborate with each other, and actually it's quite difficult to find. I know a group of street theatre artists in Bristol called Desperate Men, who are quite renowned, and they generally network within the theatre groups. And actually for one of their performances, they wanted an artist to turn a car into a percussive instrument by cutting it up with blow torches and arc welders and the like, and turning it into a percussive instrument. They really needed a way of talking to people outside of their own sort of network. And Bristol Creatives is exactly that sort of project, really.
So the opportunity for cross-pollination, as it were.
Absolutely, yeah. Absolutely. One of the artists for the Illuminate event is, she's a stilt walker, and she's going to be working with a costume designer, and they've met up through the Bristol Creatives and the Phoenix 52 projects.
Mm. So tell us a bit more about your creative directory. I mean, what specifically will artists be able to do with that?
Absolutely. Well, it's a fantastic way of promoting yourself, but also for the people out there listening to this broadcast at the moment. If you're looking for a photographer to come and take photographs of your wedding, or you want to get a portrait of your wife or your daughter, or you want to buy wedding rings or fascinators, you can come to the creative directory and have a look. And it's done by category, and you'll find Bristol artists that can basically cater to your every creative need. Wow. There's a workshop facilitators, that's a word I can't say, category. So if you're a community centre and you want someone to come in and run a mask making workshop with children for Valentine's Day, then come along to our website and have a look at the creative directory.
Okay, I mean, so what is your website? Have you got any more details if people want to get in contact?
Absolutely. The best thing to do is to go and have a look at the website, which is www.bristol.com and then creatives with an S at the end. That's all one word, .co.uk. Everything you need to know is on there. We are trying to encourage as many people to pay our £30 a year membership scheme so that we can keep the network going. We don't need very much money, but we do need to be sustainable now. Now things are so tight with the Arts Council funding and you know, the credit crunch and all that kind of stuff. We're trying to be a bit more entrepreneurial in our approach.
And quite right too. Thank you very much, Sally.
Now a feature by one of our volunteers, Addy Ulayton, called Life, Death and Washing Machines. Can you figure out what is meant by washing machines?
What is your understanding of dialysis?
Do you know, I don't really understand what dialysis is at all. I think it's something that people have to do to themselves if they have liver problems, or is it kidney problems? I don't really know.
Kidney dialysis is when somebody is quite seriously ill, and what happens is they have to have their blood cleaned.
Dialysis is when a patient's kidney function is seriously impaired, which means that the blood's not cleansed sufficiently, so they have to go on and undergo dialysis, which is a machine that actually takes the blood from the body, cleans it, places it.
Hello there, my name's Dr. Helen Campbell. I'm one of the renal consultants here at Southmead Hospital, Bristol. Dialysis is required for anyone whose kidneys don't work. The kidneys get rid of the waste products from our blood. And without our kidneys working, we need a machine to do this job for us. There are two types of dialysis, hemodialysis and peritoneal dialysis. And today we're going to talk about hemodialysis. For patients who require hemodialysis, their blood is taken out of their bodies, goes through a machine which cleans their blood just like the kidneys do, and then goes back to their bodies. This takes 4 hours for each session, and 3 sessions are required each week. So that's 4 hours, 3 times a week. This has a huge impact on a person's lifestyle, on their social life, and on their ability to work.
How do you feel about dialysis?
Well, at the moment, it's keeping me alive. It runs my life. I have to live my life around the machines, like 3 times a week, 4 hours at a time. You know, you have to build your life around it. But hopefully, with progress and things getting better, perhaps a transplant, perhaps I can then move on to get my life back into order again.
What is the future of dialysis?
At the present, there is no replacement for dialysis. As long as people have kidney failure, and the chances of kidney failure are increasing in our population at the moment, we will always need dialysis. The only alternative is transplantation. Not everyone is suitable for transplantation or well enough for a kidney transplant. There are two types of transplants available at the moment. There are transplants from people who have passed away, who have been kind enough to offer themselves as donors. And then there are also live kidney transplants. At present, there are 5,000 people waiting for a kidney transplant in this country. So the chances of getting a kidney transplant are really quite low unless you have a live donor.
What is your hope for the future?
Well, obviously, to get a transplant would be the ideal thing, so I could then continue back with a normal life. Otherwise, I'd hate to think that I've got to spend the rest of my time tied to these machines. It's okay at the moment, but, when you've lived an active life, you feel as if you can't do anything. You're just tied. So hopefully, a transplant and move on to build my life up again.
Thank you very much to Adia Layton there for her feature, Life, Death and Washing Machines. Hopefully all should now be clear.
Next up, we've got a track from LCD Sound System, All My Friends. That was All My Friends by LCD Sound System. Our next feature is by Tony Gosling in a series of interviews with local historian Julian Jones. Bristol has one of the richest heritages of local history in any city in Europe, and in the 1980s, the Temple Local History Group began. Engineer, historian and author Julian Lee Jones is author of the fascinating book Bristol Curiosities. Dialect's Tony Gosling continues his conversations with Julian about Bristol's hidden history. This week, Julian talks about one of Bristol's most notorious and consistently richest and elite organisations, the Merchant Venturers.
Merchant Venturers, they are the people who put up the money for the exploration. They put up the money for the protection vessels, admittedly protecting their own members' interests, to stop the customers leaving St James Fair to be attacked by pirates. They also protected their members against the depredations of the press gangs. All right, this is self-interest, but no more than any other group of self-interest, I think. As they are the sort of largest landowners, yes, I think they're always going to attract comment. And a lot of cases, it's probably perfectly justified. I mean, there was the incident where, I mean, they're the ground landlords of pretty well all of Clifton and the Downs, jointly now with the city. But I mean, there are instances where they controlled their rights and privileges very, very strictly, which made them unpopular. I mean, in the ground in Redland and in Clifton is red, hence the name, because it's very high iron content. And one enterprising lady lived in Cornwallis Crescent, for example, was iron mining in her back garden, which they put paid to because they owned the iron, the mineral rights. There was another incident, and I'm trying to remember the biblical quote, but this was a time when people used biblical quotes or Shakespearean quotes in their daily correspondence. And I lived in one time in Victoria Square, and the Green in the early 50s, that was another one of the residents' private gardens. In other words, it was fenced round, walled round, and you had as a resident, you had a key to the gardens. Two interesting incidents there, going right back to when Victoria Square was first built. It was let out for speculative building by the merchant venturers. Three sides were built, but the person who bought the lease for the Lansdowne Road side was very tardy in completing his side of the square. It reached a stage where they threatened to withdraw the lease because he hadn't actually exploited the potential. And he finally did it. Because what they threatened to do, to actually encourage him, they threatened to put up their own row of houses along the Lansdowne roadside, but to put them round so that to build it where Lansdowne Road is now, so they wouldn't be encroaching on his land, but he would then have a plot of land which was looking at the back of all the houses on that side of the square. So this is the sort of clout they used. They encouraged him, which is why the building on that side of the square is different in style from the rest of it, because he actually saw sense and quickly put up a terrace of houses. But there are numerous instances where they, I don't remember who it was now, they built a road across to his house at Julian Road, across at Rocklees by the water tower, which is his own private carriage road, and they made him dig it up. So they're very, and I suppose it's true today, they're very well aware of their rights and privilege, but they have done a lot for the city as well. The Merchant Venturers College, for a start.
Julian Lee Jones there talking to Dialect's Tony Gosling about Bristol's elite, the Merchant Venturers, who count architect George Ferguson and the Queen, as well as pretty much every super rich and powerful person in the city among their number. More local history from Julian Lee Jones next week. The Temple Local History Group's website is History For You, and that's the number 4.info.
This next feature comes from this year's Edinburgh Fringe Festival. Our reporter Anthea Page interviews Rebecca Payton and Martin Bartelt about the play they wrote called Sometimes I Laugh Like My Sister. Since her big sister, BBC journalist Kate Payton's murder in Somalia in February 2005, Rebecca has had a strange time. Rather than a wedding to organise, Rebecca's one-woman show gallops through the curious collieries of the worst of times, discussing death at dinner parties and encouraging guests not to play dead themselves in order to avoid that traumatised friend of theirs. This is a play about racism, censorship and journalist safety.
I'm in the press office at the Edinburgh Fringe and I'm going to introduce you to Martin.
Hello.
From Germany.
Yes, also if I'm now living in Switzerland.
So tell us why you're at the Fringe.
I wrote a show together with Rebecca Payton, an actress who lives in London, and we created Sometimes I Love Like My Sister, which is a story of a BBC journalist who got killed in 2005 in Mogadishu. She got shot there while she was working there. And actually, Kate Payton is a sister of Rebecca Payton, the actress with whom I wrote the play and who is now going to perform it every day at 1 o'clock at the hut in the Pleasance Courtyard.
What happened then when she got shot? Was she just in the wrong place at the wrong time? Did she know it was a dangerous area?
Actually, she knew that it's a very dangerous area and she had a lot of doubts if she should go or not. But the problem was, on the same day, she had an interview with her boss and her contract renewal was in doubt. So people told her, oh, we have doubts about your, if you're willing to go or not and for your job. And so in the end, she felt a lot of pressure that she has to go. But she had also only 4.5 days to go, which is definitely not enough time to go to such a dangerous place. In 2005, Somalia was one of the, perhaps the most dangerous country in the world. And then she went there just with a freelancer, and they both were new to the country. They never went before. So specialists have a lot of doubts if this was really the right thing to do.
Why did they shoot her?
Actually, local specialists told or reported that it was a warlord who ordered her killing. And it was not the person of Kate. It was just a Western journalist who was there. Because at this moment, the warlords did not want to have Western journalists in the country.
Did they catch the killers?
No. And it was just somebody who got hired, probably, who had to pay his rent. And the family even, I mean, they never thought that they will to bring to justice, whatever this means, the killer. And in the meanwhile, again, specialists reported that the warlord who ordered Kate's killing was bombed and probably killed by the Americans.
Was her body brought back to Britain?
Her body came back to Britain because she was not dead immediately. She got operated in Mogadishu, and then at first the family got the news that everything is okay, that she will survive. So everybody relaxed a little bit. I mean, it was quite a shock to hear, oh, my daughter, my sister is shot. But then, nevertheless, she died during the night. And then the UN lifted her corpse out to Nairobi. She was based in Johannesburg, and her family then... Her mother was actually on holiday with her in Johannesburg, and she got the news that her daughter got shot while she was in Kate's house in Johannesburg.
So did the BBC feel any responsibility for what happened?
Of course, there was an inquest into the death of Kate's murder, and the BBC declined, or they even did not want anybody to look into the planning of Kate's trip if it was part of how she died.
Well, Kate's sister has actually arrived. Would you like to say a few words for radio?
Yeah, sure.
Can you tell us about your role?
Yeah, well, essentially, it's a show about my experiences since my sister's death. It also includes bits of fact about the situation she was in. And it's quite an experience to play kind of my own life in the show. It's what we really want to do is present a very warm story about grief and trauma and loss. And, you know, often in our culture, we feel pushed away. We feel we can't approach people. And people who are suffering feel they are ostracized, sometimes by the people who are closest to them. We just wanted to make a place where people can come and see a story, and it's a safe context, and it's lovely to be asked questions, because that's kind of the point, is that people ask questions.
Did you find it helped you cope with her death, doing this play?
I don't really know about that. I guess because I've only lived the life that I have since Kate's death, and this has been 3 years of work with Martin. I'm very glad to be making something useful out of it. A lot of people ask me whether it's cathartic, and I don't think it is cathartic, really, because I don't think watching catharsis on stage is a particularly edifying experience for the audience.
I hope what we've done is craft something that's very specific and very watchable, whereas actually watching somebody go to pieces in front of you is not a very easy experience, and I'm not sure there's a great deal to be learnt from it.
So what reaction have you had from audiences generally?
It's incredible. People seem to love it, which Martin and I are on our own trajectory, and obviously we like it and we think it's a great way of looking at these things. But remarkably, people have come up with their own stories of loss and trauma, death, obviously divorce, various difficulties that people have had. They come and ask me questions that I think they wouldn't feel empowered to ask if we hadn't already said, come and ask, because we're like, yeah, you can ask us. There might be things I don't want to talk about. I haven't come across any yet. There might be things I don't want to talk about. But it's fine to ask, you know, there's no issue with asking. And people seem to love it, and they laugh. My mum laughed the most. People really, really laugh, which is lovely, and just what we're looking for. Not that people have to laugh, they can cry all the way through if they like. That they do laugh is wonderful and liberating for us all, I think.
A lot of audience members tell us it's quite a relief that there is such a easy dealing with scenes of taboo, of trauma, and that this allows themselves to come closer to their own taboos and to open them up, to let them disappear.
Like a shared experience.
I think so. I mean, I think in any case, like every audience member comes with his, her own story to see our show. And I think, yeah, if we have 50 people in the audience, afterwards we have 50 different stories about our show. But this, I think, is actually where we always worked towards, that we just offer a story. And then everybody is free to take or not to take whatever they want. We are dedicating this show every day to 5 journalists who get killed in the field, because every year they get killed, journalists, loads of them, and not only in Afghanistan, Iraq, and Iran, no, in all over the world. So every day we choose 5 different journalists and we dedicate this show to them and to their families.
And do you have any plans to tour?
Yeah. We would like to bring it to London next spring. And also we have plans to tour it internationally, because we did already some previews in Switzerland. We are working in collaboration with Reporter Without Borders, with Index on Censorship. And people are very, very interested in the show. And also because, it's a light show. It's sometimes I say it's a funny show, and people go like, oh, no, it's not funny at all. There are funny moments. It's not funny. And there is internationally a big request for a show like that.
What about Bristol? Any chance?
We're going to tour nationally, absolutely. No doubt about that. There are various, we're lucky, quite a few venues are coming to see the show here. To see whether they'd like to book it. And there's a lot of enthusiasm when I talk about it. And I think Martin finds the same thing. People can be quite... It can be quite scary at first. And then once they get talking to us, I think they can see what the show might be. And, yeah, definitely Bristol. My oldest friend lives in Bristol with her husband and their baby, and any excuse to come down to Bristol, quite frankly. Who wouldn't want to be in Bristol? It's such a lovely place. And Martin hasn't been there yet. It's new to Martin.
I was never in Bristol. Yeah. I want to know Bristol.
It's a treat coming up for you. So, yeah, definitely Bristol.
Thank you very much to Anthea Page. And thank you also to Rebecca Payton and Martin Bartelt for talking about the play Sometimes I Laugh Like My Sister, which is performed at the Edinburgh Fringe this year.
Now for the second part of our interview from Stokescroft Museum with Katie Bauer. You may remember last week we heard from Katie, who's recently opened the Stokescroft Museum. And in this final part of the interview, we hear about the reaction to the newest museum in Bristol and what Katie is planning to do with the museum next.
What reaction has the museum got? Because you've only been open a few weeks. So how has it gone, and what do the kind of community feel about it?
Well, I'm very excited because exactly the kind of mixture of people. Like I say, I mean, the main thing and the main ethos of PRSC is inclusivity. So often people do something that's viewed as political and it immediately cuts out huge sections. It sets itself in opposition to sectors of the community, and we're not interested in that at all. We think that's the tragedy of the class system, that's the tragedy of our economic model, and that people should be not be frightened of each other. And it's fantastic. The museum has worked exactly like that. My first visitors was a woman who lives in the Dove Street flats and her little girl of about 3 or 4. And the little girl sat and did some drawings while her mum looked around. Family, a lot of children, a lot of families come because there isn't really anywhere for them in this area that's nice to go. You can go to a cafe, I suppose. You know, people with tattoos and piercings, students, people from overseas, tourists, all sorts of people have come. Yeah, the reaction has been fantastic. People are completely amazed, which is great. I thought I'd build it and just take that risk. If nobody came and everybody said it was rubbish, then I'll just have to take that on the chin and close it.
So would you say this is a museum for Bristol then, as opposed to just Stokes Croft?
Yes and no. It is Stokes Croft Museum. Everything in this museum is particular to Stokes Croft. However, we feel it's not, you know, Stokes Croft is just the human story. We have everything here. We have rich people, poor people, shattered people, generous people, religious people. We have everything here. Immigrant people, a hugely diverse community. So in a way, we're sort of everywhere. Stokes Croft is everything and everywhere. It's about taking the time to notice and discuss. And if you went into just about any community in Britain, you could build a museum there. You could go onto a council estate in Glasgow and build a museum there, because there would be, I guarantee it, unlikely and beautiful human endeavour. And so it's a kind of a vote of an optimist. It's optimistic.
How do you think the museum will document the latest kind of struggles in the Republic in the future? So, like, say no to Tesco campaigns are a good example. How do you want the museum to be exhibiting that in the future, or even now?
Well, we've made a lot of films, actually. I've made a lot of films about the Tesco campaign, which are on view at the museum for people. There's a little screen here. There's a lot of interesting information, because mostly people are simply, they're ignorant of the facts in the way that anyone is. I was, until you take the time to focus on it specifically. So people come here and then they say, oh, Tesco, blah, blah, blah. And I say, would you like to watch a film? And they watch, I have a fantastic film here that I shot of Mark Thomas, comedian and activist, talking before a show he did here in Stokes Croft about his Tesco fight in his community. It's about democracy, really. It's about listening to what local people want. It's about not being bullied and overwhelmed by corporate forces. So it's, you know, the Evening Post recently have had this kind of weird poor old Tesco campaign, and it's rather sinister, because actually the issue here is, if a community say they don't want something, they have the right to say that, and surely their public space is theirs to decide. Unfortunately, it's not the case. And corporations have spent a lot of money and a lot of time in the last 10 years. A globalized economy has made a perfect platform for them to gain enormous power legally. And so councils are also bound legally by the laws that the pressure groups, that the people that you're trying to fight, made the law, because that's always been the case. Power makes the law, and power in our society is money. It's about that. It's about democracy, and it's about economy. And as we've seen from the recent crash, a globalized economy is a terrible thing, a terribly fragile thing. And the people who suffer, of course, when banks crash, are not the bankers who get huge bonuses. They're the small people who've saved. Their money is gone. And it's an outrage. And people come in and they're unsure about Tesco. And I just sort of let them watch the film, and they all go out of here going, I'm not going to shop at Tesco anymore. And that's what we've come to. The only way, we don't really have a democratic process in this country anymore. What you can do is vote with your money. If you don't believe in something, you don't shop there.
So what's the future for the museum? Have you got any particular exhibits or events coming up that you could tell us about?
Well, that's very exciting, because as you can see, it's a funny little room, Michaela. But what we did is we built this platform so that people could observe the street from a fantastic viewpoint on Stokes Croft, write down their observations, because I guarantee if you sit there 5 minutes, you'll see something hilarious or terrible or something notable. It looks like a little stage, and although it's so small, when we had the opening here, we had a kind of numbering queuing system, and it worked very well. We had nearly 400 people through here.
on the opening night, we sent them round the corner to Jamaica Street Studios, where PRSC has the whole ground floor now. We had bands there and booze there, and then they'd come back when their number was called. So you can actually do things with a lot of people here if you have this funny little system, and then you kick them all out after 10 minutes and get the next lot in. And places like Fat Paul at the Croft, which is a venue just up the road here, he wants his band to play here, and then we do the numbering system. They play a short set, then we shoo everybody up to the Croft and then have the next batch in, so that actually it's quite it makes for a little adventure of a night out, and people really enjoyed it. They felt like they weren't irritated. Oh God, I have to go around the corner. They're like, oh, it's sort of like a game. So we can actually do, we are going to have some performance here. And then at the end of the year, Christmas time, when because we don't have any funding, I will have a little exhibition here of pottery. I don't know if you can see up there, the pottery they didn't find on Turbo Island in the archaeological dig. I'm going to have an exhibition of that on this platform and try and sell some. And I would love people to come up with ideas for projections onto the window. We have a screen that we can put up at night. We can have projections. We can have performance in the window here. We can have little gig here. There's a band that's going to have their album launch here. So please come and have a look at it. And if you have any ideas for showing off, any ideas for how you could use the space, then I'd love people to come and see it. As for how long the museum will be here, people have really loved it, which is great. And so I'd like it to continue. What I do need desperately is volunteers. If anyone would like to volunteer to come and sit at the museum some days, then I'd love to hear from them.
Okay, so could you give us just some information about how to get in contact?
The website for the museum is Stokes Croft Museum, and it has our information there. Otherwise, you can write to me at stokescroftmuseum@gmail.com. So please get in touch with me. Also, if donate any money, that would be great, because, yes, we do struggle along. And it would be wonderful if we did have any help, because it would give us an opportunity to do more exciting things, better publicity. You know, getting some flyers made is 75 quid. Any help is gratefully received. Thank you.
And just to reiterate the opening times, if people do want to come down and check it out.
Yes, I'm afraid the opening times are a bit funny. I open from 11 till 3 on Wednesday, Thursday and Friday, and from 12 till 4 on Saturdays. Ideally, I'd have somebody here on Sunday. So again, any volunteers, and it's a lovely place to sit. Get in touch at stokescroftmuseum@gmail.com.
Thank you so much, Katie. That was really, really interesting. It was great to meet you. Thank you.
Thanks so much.
That was me speaking to Katie Bauer there at the newly opened Stokes Croft Museum. The museum is at 81 to 83 Stokes Croft Road, just opposite the canteen. It's open 11 a.m. to 3 p.m. on Wednesdays, Thursdays and Fridays, and 12 a.m. to 4 p.m. on Saturdays. Entry fee is £1 for adults and children can go free. And as Katie said, she's always on the lookout for volunteers. So if you are interested, please give her a mail. That's at stokescroftmuseum@gmail.com. And in addition, if anyone would like to donate, she'd be very, very grateful. So you can get in touch via the same address.
Now, we pride ourselves on listening to opinions from all over the world here on Dialects. And this week is no exception. We hear from Kenya. William Mbuvi is a businessman and environmental campaigner who contacted the show. And I myself asked him over the telephone with the wonders of modern technology about a new road that the Chinese are planning. They're planning on building a huge road right across the Serengeti. This will disrupt the traffic of one of the last great migrations of animals in the world. 2 million animals stampeding across the Serengeti. And I also discussed with him Heroes Day, or should I say Kenyatta Day, which is celebrated throughout Africa.
My name is William Mbuvi. I'm from Mutiangome village in North Division of Kitui County. Mm-hmm. But I live in a Mali town where I do business, marketing business. I'm actually not an MP, but I'm a political activist with passion for social justice.
I noticed that on the 20th of October every year, you did celebrate Kenyatta Day, but recently it's been renamed Heroes Day. Which would you rather be celebrating the most, Kenyatta Day or Heroes Day?
There is a big debate here on whether to call it Kenyatta Day or to call it Hero Day. I understand that sometime I was arrested when we tried to celebrate Kenyatta Day as a Hero's Day. We were arrested, that was in the year 2000. And we fought until the new constitution was passed. And I am not aware of how the government wants to celebrate this year's Kenyatta Day, or so to speak. But for my own view, I believe this should be the Heroes Day to celebrate everybody, not just Kenyatta, but all the people who are fighting for independence in Kenya. They need to be honoured through Heroes Day rather than just honouring one person, Kenyatta.
In the Guardian here in the UK, on page 3, we had a full page spread on a proposed new road that's running west to east right through the Serengeti National Park. Scientists are saying that this is going to block the migration of animals that move north to south into the Masai Mara Game Reserve in southern Kenya, and tourism is going to be affected as well, and there's a potential long-term threat to wildlife.
I'm aware of the developments which are going on concerning Serengeti and the new road which is supposed to be constructed in Tanzania. I'm aware that the government of Tanzania is determined to ensure that the project goes on. I'm also aware that various groups, particularly the scientists, are opposed to that project, and they are suggesting that the route should be there must be a rerouting of that road to ensure that migration of animals is not affected, and also the ecological nature of that place is not interfered with. Basically, I will not be for or against whatever is going on, but I will root for dialogue between the government of Tanzania and the environmental activists who are calling for an out of that project. They may come up with an amicable solution to this problem. I'm suggesting that there must be a balance between development and conservation. In as much as we would like to conserve that ecological zone, we must also look at what is it the government that wants to do in that place, and we try to come up with a suggestion. Maybe some of the scientists are suggesting that there must be rerouting of that road, and I will go for that kind of suggestion, that the government of Tanzania does not lose out in what they want to do with the project.
Yeah.
And also the animals also are taken care of. That is what I call balancing between development and the conservation efforts that we are carrying out.
Thank you very much to William and Booby. We wish him well, and let's find out what happens to him in the months and years to come. Well, time for a bit of poetry. Initially, I was expecting our Trevor Bardwell-Mahill. I understand he might be a little bit ill, Tim. Is this right?
Oh, yeah, well, he can't make it for a couple of weeks anyway. I'm not sure exactly.
Well, it's my pleasure instead, not instead, but an equal pleasure to introduce Tim Burrows. He's been in many times before, as eagerly listeners will know. What have you got for us this week, Tim?
This is a more, sort of more serious poem. It's about human cloning. It's something I wrote, well, a little bit back, and I gave Trevor my CD, and he liked it, so I dedicated it to Trevor. And it's trying to think about what's sacred about us as people. So this is Against Human Cloning.
Okay.
Time to step back and think. Time to pause on the brink. To tamper with the stuff of existence. To pep up human evolution, to germinate a super race, every supremacist, racist dream. What colour would you like her eyes to be? How intelligent do you want his brain to be? 6 foot or 6 foot three? Do you want her to look more like her father or her mother? Do you want him to be an aggressive warrior or an angel of peace? Do you really want to choose these things? What if this year's model resents next year's features? What if your child feels detached from her parents? What if the new selected implanted features go wrong? What if designer man becomes Frankenstein's monster? What if Power Inc. produces its own totally obeying, totally loyal army of human clones? No reasoning with these. They are made for corporate policy, even if it is an exploitative, destructive folly. Time to step back and think. Time to pause on the brink. I am the other, bred by business, penetrated by micro-needle, helpless egg on glass, blinkered big business other, bred for the Bible and the gun. I am the other, which other, whose other, confused with whose other. I am another, a new other, sort of related, not mated but created other.
Thank you very much, Tim. What else do you have for us?
I have certain, my latest poems are on my phone.
Very high tech, you see.
And this is about the poet, the role of the poet, and creating, like artists do, connecting with the world of magic.
You wrote this on your phone. Where were you with your phone at the time? Can you remember?
I think I wrote it at different places. I've been reading about where we've come from and where we're going, and I'm doing this big project about it.
Okay.
And this is kind of part of it. So this is... it also could take some of the art world in. I do not live in the realm of mortals. I exist in the outline of the abstract, in the shadow cast by a sculpture in the round, caught in the grounds of a group of figures in a bas-relief, a lamentation pierced for drama, set in the fading glimmering light at dusk, that dusts the hair with a sheen that gives the eyes a glint of the unknown, a passage through to the realm of magic.
Thank you very much, Tim Burrows, and more from you next week.
Thanks, John.
I've got a poster in front of me for anyone who knows Bradford, as in Bradford-on-Avon, which is near us, not the Bradford up north. It's titled Bradford at War. It's not at the moment, I should hasten to add, but it was, and that's what it's about. So if you're interested in Bradford at War, there are exhibitions and things going on at the library in the Bradford-on-Avon, which is in Bridge Street. Second World War Secret Bunkers, put together by Nick McCamley, will be going on at the library Thursday 7th of October, and that's going on at 7:30 in the evening. If you want further information on this or anything I'm saying, Tourist Information Centre, that's the place to go. The tickets are £5 or museum members £3. They have an exhibition about Bradford at War, which is going on until the 8th of October, about Bradford at War, so that's the thing.
I now have the pleasure of welcoming our resident music fanatic Jeff Sparks into the studio with his What's On Guide. How are you doing, Jeff?
I'm all right, thank you. Good afternoon, this is your What's On Guide from Dialect Radio. Starting with Wednesday, 6th of October, Marcel will be performing at the Tunnels in Bristol and Exeter Mews, Bristol. Doors open at 7:30 p.m. and tickets are £8 in advance and £6 in advance for NUS. On Thursday, 7th of October, the Members will be performing with support from the Stingrays at the Thunderbolt in Bath Road, Bristol. Doors open at 7 p.m. and tickets are £8 in advance. On to Song of the Week and our future Black Country Communion. This group formed in January 2010 and includes former Black Sabbath and Deep Purple vocalist Glenn Hughes, Jason Bonham, who is the son of the Led Zeppelin drummer John Bonham, Joe Bonamassa, who is one of the world's greatest guitar players, and former Dream Theater keyboardist Derek Sherinian. This is from their self-titled debut album, and it's a song titled Black Country.
Yeah! to the black country.
That was Black Country Communion with Black Country from the self-titled debut album. For more information, you can check out www.bccommunion.com. Into Saturday, 9th of October, Morton View will be performing with support from Zedland at the Louisiana in Wapping Road, Bristol. Doors open at 8 p.m. and tickets are £5 in advance. Finally, on Tuesday, 12th of October, Glenn Hughes will be performing with support from Scott McKeown at the Fleece in St Thomas Street, Bristol. Doors open at 8 p.m. and tickets are £20 in advance. That is all from me. Thanks for listening. Have a great week. Take care and goodbye.
Great stuff. Thank you, Jeff. Thanks for informing us about Bristol's vibrant music scene as ever.
Well, that's all from Dialect Radio this week. Studio guests were Sally Ray, the features by Tony Gosling, Anthony Page, Michaela Dennis and Adieu Layton. What a lot we had. Excellent.
We had some poetry from Tim Burrows, not forgetting, and Jeff Sparks, of course, with his What's On Guide. The studio engineer was Ryan Hardman, with assistance from Michael Noyce. The producer was Lee Duffield, and it's goodbye from me, Michaela Dennis.
And myself, John Peters Coleman. Goodbye.
year we get a gospel dance record as good as Sounds of Blackness's Optimistic or this one, Lisa Taylor's.
For years they smelled as beautiful.